This podcast of Bookworm is a production of KCRW Santa Monica and KCRW.com. Support for KCRW podcasts comes from the Southern California Lexus dealers.
Funds for Bookworm are provided in part by Lannan Foundation.
You are a human animal. You are a very special breed. For you are the only animal who can think, who can reason, who can read.
From KCRW Santa Monica, I'm Michael Silverblatt, and this is Bookworm. Today I'm happy to have as my guest someone who's been a guest many times, Jane Smiley, and she's written a book called 13 Ways of Looking at the Novel. It's a critical book. It's more or less in three sections, a history of the novel itself, a kind of guide to how you can write a novel, followed by the reading of 100 novels over a period, I think, of 3 years.
Yeah.
And it's very interesting because I think, you know, what's betrayed in this book is that Jane Smiley loves novels as much as anyone, as much as I do, and I love novels as much as anyone, and yet we come from different sides of the fence as far as novels go. I love the miraculous and the unreal, the novel that transports. In other words, I read to escape from life, and Jane read in order to understand people more deeply. And I was trying to escape the people I was understanding all too well. And yet we both love novels.
You know, I think that often with children who become novelists, they do read to escape. I read the Bobbsey twins. I didn't read fantasy, but I read the Bobbsey twins and Nancy Drew. And I found that that was just as good escape fiction as anything else, you know, because my desire as a child, I didn't have brothers and sisters, and I wished I did. So if I could have had a twin or a twin plus another set of twins in the family, that was my idea of heaven.
Well, for me, it was the miracle stories in the Bible, especially when the arks, having been stolen, roll back to their sacred area all on their own. As if they were returning children, but these children had no breadcrumbs to follow. I loved that as much as I loved the stories about Potiphar's wife, that marvelous trick in which someone says, if you don't sleep with me, I'll tell Pharaoh that you did.
Well, I didn't come from a Bible-reading family, so the stories in the Bible were quite remote from me. But I do remember having a storybook and in it I read over and over about Midas, King Midas, and the Midas touch. And I do remember how distressed I was that everything became immobilized and dead when he touched it. And so that affected me, and probably another example of realism.
Well, my first myth, in fact, was perhaps the most unreal of all. It was in fourth grade when our teacher told us the story of Pandora's box.
I remember that one, too. That was very scary.
Hope waiting after all of the furies and terrors had been unleashed on the world, hope still being there at the bottom of the box. But the problem was she had told us that she wouldn't be writing on the blackboard that day, and I kept hearing it as Greek mints. And I went home to my parents, and I said, I want to read more of these Greek mints.
Oh, that's so funny.
They had no idea what I was talking about.
Oh, that's so funny. See, I always saw the hope as the poor consolation for all the other things. The things that were fearful seemed to me to be much more powerful than that little bit of hope lying around in the box. So to me, the Pandora's box was quite a frightening story.
Oh, I thought it was frightening, but I think I loved the fear. And that's another thing. In the course of 13 Ways of Looking at the Novel, there is the call for a lengthy,
written
narrative.
Prose
narrative.
Lengthy, written prose narrative with a protagonist.
With a protagonist. And for me, there was a certain kind of book where you read to see just how evil the person in the book could get.
Uh-huh.
You know, it was there in childhood, and then it was there when I grew up in books like Naked Lunch, just how much depravity could be fit in between covers. And so, again, the other well, side of the
fence. Well, I did read Justine. I did read and actually quite enjoy and love the book, the Marquis de Sade's book, Justine.
And not only that, one of your favorites, at least by the evidence of this, is The Trial. And Kafka
yes.
seems to do fairly well. And, you know, he's no one's realist or
no.
he's a realist by paying attention.
But, you know, someone told me early on when I was first reading Kafka, which may be an apocryphal story, that when he read The Metamorphosis aloud to Max Brod, he couldn't stop laughing. And to me, that was always a sign that Kafka didn't see his work in the same way that people after him did.
Now, I have a suspicion about this book, which is 13 Ways of Looking at the Novel by my guest Jane Smiley, published by Knopf. In the introduction, you say you had come to a kind of crisis point where writing the novel Good Faith, was it?
Mm-hmm.
Had become less than enjoyable for you. And you mention also that you'd become involved in The Course in Miracles, which you mention has among its tenets that people are not different from one another, that this is an illusion or a nightmare that we practice, that in fact, like the Buddhists, what we see around us is regarded as a kind of veil of illusion
mm-hmm.
to be penetrated. And most of the beliefs of the realist novel are contradicted by The Course in Miracles. The realist novel wants people to be different, to be mm-hmm. differentiated by stylized gestures. So my suspicion came that this book is a juncture point as you make a transformation to becoming a novelist who is capable of creating the ultimate true realism, which is the realism that everything we see veils truth.
Well, at the same possibly those things are true, and yet being a novelist really did prepare me to understand and accept a lot of The Course in Miracles, because I could see by looking at novels, I could see how the world could be a conceit, or the world could be a kind of mental projection, in the way that a novel is a mental projection. The more common the more common metaphor is a play or some kind of performance.
Or a dream.
But to me, a waking dream that is a lengthy conceit is a big, long novel. And it's taking place in your mind, and it's entertaining you and seeming to give you all sorts of emotional ups and downs and pleasures. And then you close it and it's over. So once I sort of grasped what The Course in Miracles was getting at, I realized that, yeah, a novel and what The Course in Miracles says the world is are quite similar. So since I understood that one was a kind of a false thing that was meant to demonstrate something about the truth and also meant to show you a way to solve a particular dilemma or to find a way toward a more true way of doing things, then I could see a lot about The Course in Miracles, too.
Well, one of the places where I found myself, despite everything, as a lover of novels, agreeing is the lengthy section in which you talk about how people who don't read novels become closed to the understanding of others. Whether I prefer the high-flown and highfalutin mm-hmm. kind of novel that couldn't be real, and you prefer the kind that insists upon and mm-hmm. invents for its plausibility, that ultimately we are both of us as novel readers looking for other people of the type who are willing to understand and see into the foreign, the strange, the different, the unknown, and that that's what we read novels for, ultimately, to make ourselves...
Well, to me, the most essential virtue of the novel is that because it's a one-on-one interaction, or not even an interaction, but a one-on-one experience between the author and the reader is always empowered by reading a novel, if only to close the novel and say, well, I don't like that, or to go on, or to buy another one, or to get another one out of the library, or whatever. And in some situations and in some societies, that little form of empowerment is a reader's only experience of agency, and yet it's a very powerful one. And I think of all the arts, let's say, the novel is the one that most asks or allows the art consumer that feeling of freedom. And it's the same from the other side, from the point of view of the novelist. You have that feeling of freedom too. I can pick this word green rather than this word verdant, and nobody is saying I can't do that. And so when I choose, you know, my 100 novels and I say, well, I like these 25, but I didn't especially like this other 25, and these middle 50 were okay, I am absolutely free to do that. And when your taste is different, you're absolutely free to do that too. And one of the things that I noticed as I was writing the book was that of the five major sort of social systems, let's say there's survival, politics, religion, I can't remember what the fourth one would be, but the fifth one is art. All of the others are based on conformity because people have to work together to do all those other things. But art is based on freedom. And when we look at an object, an art object, even from a very conformist culture, let's say a monastery in the Middle Ages where a monk is assigned to illuminate a manuscript, what we always notice is particular idiosyncratic gestures on the part of that monk. That's what fills us with pleasure. And so to me, the art is the only system that can't exist without freedom. All the others can exist without freedom. So art is the only one that's constantly saying to you, who are you in relationship to your society? Who are you in relationship to your little group, to your family, to your parents, to the whole world? And the novel even does that more explicitly because it's so based in point of view. So as we're reading, let's say, David Copperfield, we're constantly experiencing David's point of view. Well, we're experiencing the fact that it's different from our point of view. But while we're experiencing his point of view for 797 pages, we're learning very sort of drip by drip and very slowly that other points of view exist and that they are equal to ours.
I'm Michael Silverblatt, and you're listening to Bookworm from the studios of KCRW, and I'm talking with Jane Smiley, author of 13 Ways of Looking at the Novel, published by Knopf. We'll continue after this short break. I'm Michael Silverblatt, this is Bookworm, and I'm talking with Jane Smiley about 13 ways of looking at the novel. Now, I want to ask you something that lies a little bit outside the purview of 13 ways of looking at the novel, but it's on a subject that both of us hold dear. We both like the Icelandic novelist Halldór Laxness.
Oh, yes.
You mention him in the book, although he's not one of the 100 novels.
Mm-hmm.
And you particularly like independent people, and I particularly like the fortunately republished Christianity in Glacier, which is as strange as anything by Kafka.
Oh, is that right? I haven't read that. I should try that.
A man is sent to the city of Glacier because irregularities have been reported in the way they hold church services. And
oh,
before
really?
Long, this young man is writing back about stones coming to life and about the most unusual practices of Christianity that you could possibly imagine. And, you know, you're told, too, I remember when you were beginning, how did she go from the Icelandic epic to this novel of domestic dentistry? You know? but how do you suppose it is that a writer is capable of constructing such alternate and even opposing worlds from work to work?
You know, the other Laxness novels that I've read, they, too, are quite different. One he wrote that was set in Utah. Another one he wrote what was a kind of rewriting of an Icelandic saga that's much crueler in some ways than a lot of the Icelandic sagas are. They toss the babies back and forth on spear points. you know, the only thing that I can say of Laxness is that he had a tremendous fertile imagination, and it was fed not only by his reading of world literature and of Icelandic literature, but also by the folk tales and the stories that he was told as a child and a young man by his older female relatives. And so we could see maybe what we see is four or five really deep streams of tradition. And many of those traditions, quite strange, sort of coming together in a man as erudite as Laxness. And I once read Laxness's Nobel Prize speech. It was clear that he considered himself kind of a humble man. It was a kind of I can't believe how I got here sort of speech. And I think that a person like that, a writer like that, who comes from quite obscure background, very often begins life by feeling he has nothing to lose. He can be as open and free as he could possibly want to be in his choice of material. And that's what he did. And then that becomes a habit. And so you continue sort of being as open and free in your choice of material, and your imagination becomes richer and richer. And I think that's what happened to Laxness. He was quite prolific, and he was really, he's one of those writers, I think there are a few, that deserve to be constantly sort of reintroduced to the general reader.
Well, I think that there's no writer who doesn't, none of the great writers who don't deserve to be reintroduced. One of the things I love that V.S. Pritchett says in his, I think, first book of appreciations, he says, we call them great novels not because they're taught in school or because they're important or historical. They're great because they're greater than other novels. And if they happen not to be great to you right now, this may not be the period in which
this novel is great.
Yeah.
That's exactly right. One of my favorite books on my reading list was The Expedition of Humphrey Clinker, which some people have heard of, but it's sort of fallen off the table. But it is a wonderful, rich novel, and Smollett's ability to observe was very well-trained, and I just love that book.
This is what I mean exactly, because I come to this book from a writer who no longer exists in your book, and one of my favorites. John Barth wrote the introduction to Roderick Random for the Signet Classics because Smollett had been a big influence on the Sottweed factor.
Mm-hmm.
We all come to our favorites through our favorites.
Yes,
and
that's
then
right.
Discover that someone else has come through an entirely different route.
Right, and I came to Smollett through Dickens, who loved all of Smollett. And so one of my favorite moments when I was reading in this book was I was reading a book I've read several times, A Hero of Our Time by Mikhail Lermontov, which is
I came to through Nabokov.
Well,
and you came to it through...
Well, no, I just took a class in Russian literature, and we happened to read it in that class because it was a seminal novel for the Russian 19th century novel. But I came back to it this time and read it, and lo and behold, I noticed something I hadn't noticed before, which is the night before Pechorin has his duel, he reads The Tale of Old Mortality by Sir Walter Scott, a very obscure Scott novel, And Scott, too, has sort of gone underground a little bit in the modern world. And yet if you, and so I, of course, went and said, if it's good enough for Lermontov, it's good enough for me. So I got it, and I read it, and I was stunned by Scott's very intelligent analysis of religious conflict, Protestant religious conflict. And plus, you know, his general ability to tell a story and to make characters and stuff like that. So I went from The Tale of All Mortality to Bride of the Lammermoor, The Bride of Lammermoor, which in its own way is brilliant, and it's a completely different way from The Tale of All Mortality.
Now, at this point, we're sounding, I guarantee you, to my listeners, like a couple of crazies. We are bonding with one another like nobody's business.
Sure.
And yet for them, the very idea of remembering the details of 100 novels or 1,000 novels or two, as many as can fit in, please let them. But what do we say to the people now for whom this is an arcane form of entertainment and who are listening to us? And to them, we sound nuts.
Well, you know, a man came up to me at a reading yesterday, and he said, I don't want to be a writer. I want to be a reader. And I said, well, what do you mean? He said, well, I have stacks and stacks of books at home, but I don't bother to read them. And I said, what do you do instead? He said, I watch television. I said, why do you do that? And he said, because there's some good things on television. And one of the things was sports. And I said, okay, then instead of watching sports one day, go buy a book about some sport you love and read that book. Maybe it'll lead you to another book. And what I found with books for myself and among my children and my friends is one book that you like does lead you to another book. It puts you in the habit. It trains you to read. And pretty soon, the complexity of a book is the thing you crave. I never watch television. I find it sort of hard to watch movies because they're so slow. They're walking down the street. They're talking. He says one thing. She says another thing. You know, it takes place in real time. When you're used to the sort of complexity and simultaneity of what goes on in a novel, then you don't feel that a movie is faster. You feel that it's slower. You don't feel that it's bigger because it's on a big screen. You feel that it's smaller because it's short. And so, yes, you have to be trained. You have to be trained to read, just like you were trained to read the first time. But the rewards are wonderful. And after I read my 100 novels, which was really more like 130 novels, I wanted to read more, not less. I never said, I'm glad that's over.
Well, you said in the book that you thought it would be 275 novels, but you were afraid, being a slow reader, that the book would never get written.
Yes, that's true.
But you know what I sometimes think? I think that what our beloved critic Randall Jarrell said was true. He says it in Sad Heart at the Supermarket, and he says, you know, my grandmother read from something like McGuffrey's Reader, and it contained Psalms and the witches' rhyme from Macbeth, and it had bits of the Constitution or the Bill of Rights or the Gettysburg Address. Whatever it had in it were beyond her at the age when she had to begin to read.
Mm-hmm.
Nowadays, we manage to teach children to read very efficiently, but what they're reading is Run, Jip, Run, See the Rabbit, Rabbit, Run, Run, and they learn to read but have no idea of why they should read because what they're given to learn on is so boring. Now, I think this decline of readership has exactly coincided from the introduction of these books in schools that have no authors, that were written mm-hmm. by committees, that were written just to teach you to read and nothing else, and that consequently, unless you've been reading at home, says Jarrell, you're kind of at a loss for what these people are talking about is so wonderful about this art, because you've been reading the most basic, the most boring, the most childish, the most unmysterious stories in the world just because they use certain vocabulary words over and over again.
Well, I won't say that's not true, but I'll say that my daughters, who are now 26 and 22, read books when they were teenagers that I deplored. You know, series books, the Sweet Valley High series books. But, you know, and they were authorities. They could have written papers on the Sweet Valley High books. But they went on from there, and now they're quite sophisticated readers of all kinds of material and all kinds of novels. So I actually think anything you read is good rather than, you know, lamenting that we're reading the wrong thing. Let's just go on and read some more stuff that will get around to it. Somebody said to me at a reading, well, so-and-so says that when Cormac McCarthy dies, that'll be the last great American novelist will have died. And I said, you know, is that an old man who said that? Because my daughters, who are in their 20s, don't think of Cormac McCarthy as the last great American novelist. They think of maybe Sandra Cisneros as the next great American novelist. So one of the things that happens when you get old and you've read a lot of stuff is that you become jaded. But you can't then pull the curtain down on the culture for the 25-year-olds for whom it's still all interesting and new and great and wonderful. So I think it's important, even though we might be cranking out our little opinions here and there about the state of the culture, is to remember that the state of the culture is different for me, who was born in the 1940s, than it is for someone who was born in the 1980s. And I might be more jaded than they, and it's their culture. I mean, it's they're inheriting the culture, and they should inherit the culture that they desire. The novel is an object of desire. It's not an object of obligation. That chemistry text in high school was an object of obligation, but the novel is not.
I've been talking with Jane Smiley, author most recently of 13 Ways of Looking at the Novel, published by Knopf. Thank you, Jane, for joining me.
Oh, thank you. It was fun.
You can read an excerpt from 13 Ways of Looking at the Novel on the Bookworm page at kcrw.com. My associate producer is Melinda Siegel. The technical director is Mario Diaz, with production assistance from Alan Howard. I'm Michael Silverblatt. Join me again next time on Bookworm.
As you ramble through the pages, books will take you through the ages, back to days of old when knights were bold, and books, 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 books can be funny too.
Funds for Bookworm are provided in part by Lannan Foundation. This program is produced in the studios of KCRW Santa Monica. Archived editions of this and other Bookworm programs can be found online at kcrw.com. Keyword Bookworm. Copies are available. For ordering information, call 310-450-5183.
Through the pages, books will take you through the ages, back to days of old when knights were bold, and books, 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 books can be funny too. Books make you laugh and sing. Books tell you everything. They're your treasure, friends in prose and rhyme. Now it's Book of the Mouse Club time.
You've been listening to KCRW's Bookworm. KCRW offers more than 20 podcasts, including Good Food, a weekly exploration of culinary trends, tantalizing recipes, and intriguing discoveries in food and drink. Check out the podcast of Good Food at kcrw.com.